Okay, everyone, just a little brief introduction. What are we doing tonight? We are going to be studying a text called Pirkei Avot, which means literally chapters of the fathers. That is a section of the Mishnah. What is the Mishnah? A Mishnah is basically a paragraph which contains a number of laws in it, generally. Most of the Mishnahs are legal. That means they contain halakha, laws. What is a halakha? It's basically a directive of how to act in a particular situation, particular time, particular place. In the words of another rabbi, you have a case and you have the directive. Okay. However, this section of the Mishnah is a little different. The Mishnah was put together, edited, written in 170 to 200 of the Common Era, about 1,800 years ago, by Judah the Prince. So Judah the Prince puts together the Mishnah because what he wanted to do was, he did not want the oral traditions of the Jewish people to be lost. Jews were in exile, the Roman Empire was oppressed us, they destroyed the power of the Sanhedrin, the temple was in ruins, Jews were scattered around the world, there was a big danger. The danger was the oral traditions that we received all the way back from Moses at Sinai would be lost. So therefore, as an emergency decision, he decided he was going to write down what we call the oral law. And he wrote it down in the book called the Mishnah. He divided the Mishnah. Each Mishnah, as I said, is a paragraph with a few laws. Then they are an accumulation of Mishnahs goes into a chapter, and a bunch of chapters are in what's called a Masechta, a tractate. This is a tractate. Now, he divided them up into six larger books. Shisha Sedarim, you heard the term Shas? That's the whole Mishnah. Shisha Sedarim means six sections, six orders. The six orders are Zraim, which means agricultural laws of the land of Israel. Moed, which means times, Sabbath, festivals, everything to do with the calendar. Moed, that's Moed. Nashim, that's to do with marriage and divorce and incest and adultery and relationships and stuff like that. Everything to do with the relationship of man and woman. Nezikin, which means damages. Right? Damages, that is to say, that deals with financial law, torts, damages, jurisprudence, how the courts run, testimony, etc. Then we have Kodshim, which is holy matters, that deals with things to do with the animal world, the sacrifices in the temple, the laws of kashrut, kosher laws. And then finally you have taharot, which means purity. That's family purity, life and death, burial, and so on and so forth. Okay, those are the six orders. So for example, the tractate about Shabbat is where would you expect Shabbat to be? In which order? Moed, or the times. Tractate Kiddushin, about how to get married, where would that be? Nashim. Where is Avot? Pirkei Avot deals not with law. Pirkei Avot is the only section of the Mishnah that does not deal with law. It deals with what we call chassidut, which means piety, going beyond the law, a little bit beyond the law, right? What it means, Pirkei Avot deals with character development, personality development, character traits, virtue, etc. In which one of the sections would you put, if you were the editor, where would you put Pirkei Avot? Nowhere. You'd have to put it somewhere. You want some ethics there. Where would you put it? No suggestions? Where would you, if you're editing the Mishnah, you're writing this legal text, there's one section you need to put in something about character development. You need to put in ethics. You need to have that. You can't just have law. If you only have law, society goes down the drain. So you've got to have ethics and morals as well. So you want to put in a section about ethics and morals. Where would you put it?
Everywhere.
I would put it at the beginning. I think that's a logical place to put it. At the beginning, right? But the problem is, Judah the Prince did not put it at the beginning. Where did he put it? In the Zikin, in the middle of damages. In fact, where is it? It's right after Sanhedrin, which deals with the courts, and before Avodah Zarah, which deals with the laws of idol worship. So right smack bang in the middle of the section about damages, financial laws, the courts, etc., you've got this little tractate, Masechta, all about ethics and morals. What's it got to do with it? Why is it there? Is the question clear? Okay. Any answers here? Any have any answers? So, well, I'll tell you where it is. It's in the order of damages, right? And it is placed right after Sanhedrin, which means that's where it deals with the court system, and before Avodah Zarah, which deals with the laws of idolatry. So can anyone think of why Judah the Prince would have put it there?
Because
The silence is quite loud here. No thoughts on this? Okay. So, I'll tell you,
So it's before judgment and after...
It's after judgment, after the judges, before idol worship. Yeah. And it's in the order of damages. So there's a few reasons, right? There's a few reasons possible. Right? One of them is the following. In the days of the Talmud, and the same is true today, it's still true. In a yeshiva, when you are studying in a yeshiva, right, the main course of study in the days of the Talmud was Nezikin. Mostly, they'd spend most of their time studying the order of Nezikin. Why would they spend their time studying the order of Nezikin? The answer is it deals with the normal interaction between one person and another. Most of our interactions, unfortunately, right, a lot of damage, but it involves interaction of one person and another, society. So the laws that govern our economic interaction with other people, that govern our clashes with other people, that govern the court system, society, that's what they used to study. That's what they spent most of their time studying. There's a few reasons for that. First of all, it's the most difficult, right? It's the most difficult. So in that sense, it's a good thing to get your mind trained for the most difficult thing. You'll then find everything else easier. But there's another reason also. It's easier for another reason. Because as opposed to, let's say, an area like purity, where the concepts of ritual purity are very distant from our minds. They're not the type of things you can figure out. They're not the type of things you can use your logic to understand. And, you know, very often they're the type of things you just need to know the information and try to understand it. But it's much, much harder to wrap your mind around these concepts of purity and impurity. It's much easier to involve your mind and your own logic in areas like financial law, damages, legal issues. Is this clear? Am I making sense here? So because of that, that's what they spent most of their time doing. So now the rabbis wanted to ensure that if the curriculum is mainly being spent on the Nezikin, they wanted to make sure that everyone who went to yeshiva would also study ethics and morals. So they stuck Avot, Pirkei Avot, right in the middle of Nezikin. So if you go to the regular yeshiva in those days and you would be studying, you would have to run across the studying of ethics, and so therefore you'd get some level of ethical input. That's one possibility. Is this clear so far? Okay. Maimonides gives another reason. Maimonides says the following. He says it follows Tractate Sanhedrin, which is the laws of the court system. The courts are our leaders. He says, look, everyone needs to be moral and ethical. But he says if a private individual is immoral, then he or she causes damage. But he says they don't cause as much damage as a leader who is immoral. If one of the leaders is immoral, the damage that he can cause is much, much worse than anything we can do. A private individual, if that private individual is immoral, that's not good. If he's got a lousy character, it's terrible. But it's much worse if that person is a leader, is a judge, is a political leader. That's a disaster. So the Rambam Maimonides says, therefore, right after the tractate, the Masechta that deals with leadership, what do we have? The tractate that says, you know what qualification for leadership you need? Moral purity, ethical purity. If we would have, you know, if you look at the elections, right? I mean, if it was, right? I mean, that should really be what a leader is about. A leader should be about moral purity and personality and ethics. That's really what it should be. That's why ethics of the fathers is right there after Sanhedrin to teach us that idea. It also teaches us something else very important. You look through the Torah, the prophets and the writings, people tended to be praised. They are great leaders, right? There were two who were praised for their wisdom. There was one, who was praised for his wisdom. Who was that? King Solomon. What were the other leaders praised for? I mean, there are hundreds of leaders of the Jews throughout the centuries in the Torah, prophets, and writings. What were they praised for? Was anyone praised for their intellect? Does it describe Moses as a genius? No. Describes Moses, someone said it, as the most humble of all people. Does it describe David because he was brilliant? No. It describes him also as a humble person, right? It describes the praise for the leader is that person is not that they're a genius, but that person, you have to be an intellectual, they have to be bright, but the main qualification is they're a good person, they have a good character. So that's what Pirkei Avot teaches us to put it in that place. There's another lesson as well, because it's right before the tractate, Masechtas Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is idol worship. Right, that's one of the worst crimes in Jewish tradition is idol worship, right? So ethics is right before idol worship. What does that teach you?
Not
So some of the commentaries say the following, that it's not, a person doesn't just become an idol worshipper overnight. What it starts with is little cracks in the wall. And the little cracks in the wall initially are immorality, a lack of ethics, a lack of behaviour, relationship with other people. And from that, it gets worse and worse till eventually the person's worshipping idols. Meaning that we believe that idol worship is not something that happens overnight, but it happens from the fact that a person doesn't take sufficient care of improving their character and improving their morality. Eventually it will end up with the worst possible crimes. It may start off very small, but it will get worse and worse. So those are a few reasons for the positioning of Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, in this particular place. Any question? If you have questions, feel free to ask. If you disagree, if you don't ask a question, I'm assuming you understood everything and you agree with what I said. So if neither of those are true, please feel free to ask. Okay. Why is it called what it's called? It is called Avot, which means fathers. That's nothing to do with the content. The content of it is ethics. It should be called Musar, that means rebuke. It should be called Midot, which means character traits. There's another tractate called Midot, which is measurements of the temple. But it should be called something like that. Why is it called Fathers? Pirkei Avot, what's that got to do with anything? You know, the tractate that deals with Shabbat, guess what it's called? Shabbat. Brilliant title, right? The tractate that deals with Passover is called Pesachim, Pesach. The tractate that deals with ethics is called Avot. What's nothing to do with it. So there's a few reasons for this. First of all, one possible reason is the following. If you look at the Torah, how many commandments in the Torah? We all know 613. How many in the book of Genesis, book of Bereshit, how many commandments appear in Genesis, Bereshit?
Three.
I mean, that's pathetic. The whole book, one-fifth of the Torah, and it's got, I don't know the calculation, 3 out of 613 commandments. And by the way, one of those commandments is repeated later on, so it's unnecessary in Genesis. So there's 3 commandments in the whole book of Genesis, 610 in the rest of the Torah. What's the book of Genesis for? The answer is, the book of Genesis is called, one of the names for Genesis, Bereshit, is Sefer HaYashar, which means the book of the upright. How to act in an upright, correct manner. What we learn from Genesis is actually something you need to know before mitzvot. Before mitzvot, you know what you have to be? You have to have what we call derech eretz, which means?
Common sense.
Well, it's not common sense. Common sense is necessary for derech eretz, but I would describe derech eretz as, it literally means how to walk in the world. Means how to be a decent human being. How to interact with people, have a love for humanity. We learn that from the patriarchs and the matriarchs. We learn that Abraham, right, when he is told the city of Sodom is going to be destroyed, Sodom was an evil, corrupt, perverse, horrific place. Sodom makes Las Vegas look like Jerusalem, Lahavdil, right? So Sodom, and God to Abraham, no question, Abraham hated what went on in Sodom. Of course, Abraham was disgusted by it. And as God tells Abraham, I'm going to destroy Sodom, what's Abraham's reaction? All right. No, that's not his reaction. What's Abraham's reaction? Oh, God forbid, how could you do such a thing? What if, he tried everything he could to save Sodom. Okay, and what happens later on, you know, he tells the king of Sodom, he says, you take the property. I don't want the property. You keep the property, I'll keep the people, after he goes to war. Right, we find interaction. You know, Yitzchak is thrown out of a place called Gaza, right, by the Philistines. Right, and after they throw him out, they then come to him, because they see their economy is going down the drain. They see their luck is going bad, right? Why? They figure probably because we threw out Yitzchak, Isaac. So they come to Yitzchak, and how long does it take for Yitzchak to forgive them? About two sentences. One sentence. Right, the patriarchs loved people. They liked people. They had a positive attitude towards humanity, and they were upright, and they were honest, and they were decent. So that is what we say. There is a rule, there's a statement, Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah, which means decency preceded the Torah. Before we got the commandments, you know what we were told? Be a decent human being. Derech Eretz. So therefore, the Avot are the Avot means our ancestors, our patriarchs, our fathers, right? They are to us the teachers of what it means to be an upright, decent person. Once you've done that, then the Torah can speak to you. But I can't really speak to someone. A person doesn't understand basic decency, and you start to talk to them about lofty concepts of the Torah, it's a waste of time. It's a waste of time. Right? So therefore, you've got to start with Avot. So that's why it's called Avot. That's number one. Possibility number two, that what is said in this tractate is really the job, it's a parent. One of the prime jobs of a parent is not just to give you, is not just to provide you with food. One of the prime jobs of a parent is to teach you how to be a decent human being. In fact, Shma b'ni musar avicha, it says, listen, my son, to the rebuke of your father, v'al titosh torat imecha, and don't abandon the Torah of your mother. So your parents, their main job really is to teach you how to be a decent person. So therefore, the rabbis of the Mishnah, that's what they're doing. They're acting as our parents. They're teaching us how to be decent. So that's why it's called Avot. There's a third possibility, which is called Avot, because each of the principles said here is a primary category from which you can derive many others. In other words, don't think that the principle which they're going to say in the Mishnah is just limited to that idea. But it's something which rather is like a father, but it's got children. It's got many children. That means it has got lots of ramifications and lots of extensions in many areas of life. So these are what we call Avot of the Midot. That means the primary categories, the parents of character. But there are many things which come from that, which we can learn from that. Okay? So that's why it's called Pirkei Avot. The Talmud says in Bava Kamma, Rav Yehuda says, a person who wants to be pious, it gives three opinions. It says, Hai man deboili mehave chasida. If a person wants to be pious, what does it mean, chasid? Chasid means, from the word chesed, means kindness. That means a person who wants to, kindness is something, it's different from tzedakah. What's tzedakah? Is charity. You have to give, right? Like taxes, you have to give taxes. Kindness is something which is going beyond what you have to do. So it says that the ethics of the fathers is what we call chassidut, because it's going beyond the letter of the law. You know, if a person, it's possible for a person to be totally legal and a complete evil, corrupt person. Is that possible? I can name some names of people like that. I'll tell you afterwards, right? But it's possible for a person not to do one thing which is actually illegal, and that person can still be a complete lowlife, complete animal, right? Nachmanides talks about this. He calls it naval birshut haTorah, which means a corrupt individual, but he's doing it, but he's kosher about it. Now, what that means is, such a person is not what the Torah is about. Such a person, it's not enough. We would say it's not enough to be legal. If you go to your lawyer and you say, listen, is it okay to do this? And he says, well, it's legal. Just. Right? Does that mean it's the right thing to do? Not necessarily. It means you won't be arrested if you do it. It doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. So in other words, it's not enough just to have laws. So the Torah law says, keep kosher. So you have to have kosher food. A person could have kosher food and still be a complete glutton, right? They could sit there eating like Jabba the Hutt, right? Just stuffing their face, right? And it's all kosher food, right? That's not what it's about. So therefore, this section goes above and beyond. Now, it's interesting. The Talmud says three different opinions as what you should do if you want to be a chassid. That means you want to be pious. One opinion it says is, L'kayem milei denezikin, fulfill the words of tractate of damages. Which means, be scrupulous about not hurting other people. Be very careful about not stealing. Be very careful about all the matters of dealing with other people. That's where you have to really be careful. The other one says, milei de'avot, the matters of ethics of the fathers, which deals primarily with your own personality development. And some say, milei de'brachot, which means the matters of blessings and prayer. You think about it, there are three categories mentioned here. Nezikin is damages, avot, pirkei avot is ethics, character, and the third is brachot, prayers. Right? What are those three categories? Can anyone think of what those three categories are? I'll give you a clue. There are three types of relationships. What are the three types of relationships possible in this world? You have three. We're created to develop relationships in three areas. What are the three areas that we can have relationships in or with? Yeah.
With your parents, with your spouse, and with your children?
make it a little broader, because parents and spouse and children are all part, I would say, of one category. What category is that? A fellow human being. Okay? So that's one category. Any other categories? With God. You have to develop a relationship with God. And any other categories? With yourself. Okay? So you really, there's three categories which you have to develop your relationship. With other people, with God, and with yourself. If you actually look at the end of the Mishnah, we'll talk about a little, actually the next Mishnah, Mishnah number 2 in your outlines, it says the world stands on three things, right? It says Torah, study of Torah, Avodah, which means praying to God, Gemilut Chassidim, which means kindness to others. If you think about it, those three are the three categories I just mentioned. The study of Torah is a commandment between you and yourself to develop your own soul and your own sanctity. Right, avodah means prayer to God, praying. That's development of your relationship with God. Gemilut chassidim means kindness to others, development of your relationship with other people. So really, the three categories which the rabbis state, which is nezikin and avot and brachot, which is damages, pirkei avot and blessings, are all of those three categories. So that is, but so what we say here is that Pirkei Avot primarily is about developing ourselves and our own sanctity and our own personality and character, and obviously that has to develop our relationship with other people and with God. Okay, let's have a look at the start of the Mishnah. The Mishnah starts with the following. It says, Moshe kibel Torah m'Sinai. Moses received the Torah from Sinai. Umasara liYoshua and gave it over to Joshua. The Yeshua Lezakadim, Joshua gave it to the elders. Zakadim Leviim, the elders to the prophets. Unaviim Asaru L'Anshek Nisagdola, and the prophets gave it over to the men of the great assembly. So we have here a chain of historical transmission of the Torah from Sinai down to the men of the great assembly. The men of the great assembly was a court of rabbis, 120 rabbis, who lived at the beginning of the Second Temple era. So that means approximately 2,500 years ago. About 2,500 years ago was the beginning of the Second Temple era. And that's what so we take it from Moses all the way down to Joshua. Joshua to the elders, elders to the prophets, prophets to the men of the great assembly. Let me ask you a simple question here. Why are we starting this tractate with a chain of transmission? If you wanted to put the chain of transmission of the Torah somewhere in the oral law, where would you put it? At the beginning. It would make much more sense to put this at the beginning of the whole Mishnah. Why do you specifically put it here? Why in Pirkei Avot do we need a Mishnah that tells us where the Torah came from? That it came from Sinai to Moses, Moses to Joshua, transmitted all the way down. Why would you put it here? So there are a few possible reasons for that. Every other tractate in the Mishnah deals with what? What's the difference between this tractate and every other tractate? Aside from the fact that every other tractate, Masechet, deals with halacha, law, that's one distinction, but there's another distinction as well. What's the other distinction between this tractate and every other one? Every other one, sorry?
This doesn't have Gemara.
This tractate doesn't. No, well, there are other tractates that don't have Gemara as well. There are quite a few others that don't. So, but something intrinsic about it, something which you can say confidently, this tractate is totally different from all the others. One major difference between this tractate and all the others, aside from the ethical versus halacha. Yeah?
No disagreements here? No disagreements?
There are disagreements. There's a couple of disagreements here. And there's another tractate, Adiot, which also has no disagreements. So that we can't say. All right? Because that, we see that it's not, that's not correct. So what would be a distinction? I'll tell you the distinction. It works like this. Every other tractate deals with a specific mitzvah or specific verses in the Torah. For example, the tractate of Shabbat deals with the mitzvah of Shabbat. And there's verses in the Torah. The tractate of Bava Kamma, which is damages, deals with verses in the Torah, in Mishpatim, in Exodus 22, which talks about different damages that are caused. It talks about specific verses in the Torah or a specific mitzvah. What specific mitzvah or verse in the Torah is this tractate dealing with? There isn't. There's no, you can't, you know, every other tractate, you can look at a specific part of the Torah, the five books of the Chumash, and say, ah, it's explaining this. Or you can look at a specific mitzvah, and you can say, aha, it's explaining this mitzvah. This is the only tractate in the entire Talmud, right, in the whole Mishnah, where you can look at it and say, I don't know, which mitzvah is it explaining? Which verse in the Torah? It's not. So therefore, here especially, what we have to start with is a statement of authority of this Mishnah, to say it is true. It's not dealing with a specific mitzvah, and it's not dealing with a specific section of the Torah. However, it's just as much Torah as everything else, because it's part of the oral tradition that goes all the way back to Moses at Sinai. Is this answer clear? Yeah, clear? Yes. Is there a mitzvah? Very interesting question. The question was, is there a mitzvah to work on your character? There isn't. There isn't. Interestingly enough, Reb Chaim Vital, who's a very great Kabbalist, student of the Arizal, Reb Isaac Luria, Reb Chaim Vital points this out in the beginning, introduction to one of his books called Eitz Chaim, Tree of Life. And he asks why that's so. So he asks the same question you've got, right? Reb Chaim Vital says, why is it so? He says, you know why? We already answered this. If you were listening, you might have an answer to this question. Why is there no specific mitzvah to work on your character in the Torah? Why is it not one of the 613 mitzvot? Yeah.
Because wouldn't you already have it in you?
In other words, what we said is, well, not necessarily you're born with it, but you're obligated to do that before mitzvot. It precedes the mitzvot. If you haven't worked on yourself, it's going to be very hard for you to actually fulfill the mitzvot. Right? So it's assumed that you've done that before you get to the mitzvot. That's one. That's a possibility, right? So anyway, so one reason that Pirkei Avot starts with the chain of Torah transmission is because it doesn't apply to a specific commandment. It doesn't apply to a specific parasha, and therefore you might be wondering, so where does it all come from? So we tell you, you know what? It comes from Moses at Sinai as well. We'll talk about that a little more. Second possibility, yeah.
This only talks about you in according to yourself, right? This whole Mishnah.
This first Mishnah?
Yeah, you talked about three categories.
Oh, so you're right. It talks about the other categories as well. But primarily, it deals with the development of the self.
Primarily.
Yeah. So now we have another possibility. Did other cultures produce books of how to be a decent person?
Yes.
Many other cultures. The Greeks had books about this. Mm-hmm. Right? Quite a few different cultures have books of advice and ethics of how to be a decent person. So what we want to do here is distinguish between the fact that those were created by what people figured out. This is not created by what people figured out. This actually comes from a tradition going all the way back to Sinai. Okay. Now what I'd like you to do is look at the text of this Mishnah, just the first couple of phrases. And I want you to figure out what are the problems here. There are numerous problems in this text. Many, many problems. Yeah. Oh, sorry. There are many problems in the text. Let's read it again. Moshe kibel Torah Masinai. Moses received the Torah from Sinai and transmitted it to Joshua. And Joshua to the elders to the men of the great assembly. If you just look at that first phrase, first few phrases, there should be numerous questions which are hitting you right now, which are bothering you intensely, which you will not be able to sleep or eat until you find the answer to them. Right? What are the questions that should be really disturbing you now when you read this? I mean, you read this and you should be saying, oh my gosh, this makes no sense whatsoever.
Did Moses transmit it to the people?
Well, so question number one is, what do you mean to Joshua? Moses taught it to the whole whole Jewish people. We learned in this week's Torah reading, Moses transmitted the Torah to everyone. It's not just Joshua. Joshua is the only person Moses taught Torah to. Give me a break. Right, lots more people. So that's question number one. Any other questions?
If you continue passing it down the way it is then, isn't it inevitable for the words to change around and for it not to be legit?
That's a good question, but it's not a question on the Mishnah. Now, that's a general question. It's an excellent question. Maybe if we have time, we'll deal with that. But yeah, that's a good question. But it's not a question per se on what the Mishnah is. You look at the Mishnah, right? There's some textual questions, linguistic problems, logical problems, right? So, in other words, the first question we had is, it doesn't seem accurate. Because Moses, we know, gave it to the whole Jewish people, not just to Joshua. Any other questions? Yeah. That's right. The first statement is written, it doesn't make sense. It says Moses received the Torah from Sinai. Now that either it should be written, Moses received the Torah at Sinai, or Moses received the Torah from God. But to say he received it from Sinai, you understand the problem here? I mean, Sinai is a geographical location. You didn't get the Torah from Sinai, you got the Torah at Sinai. Or he got the Torah from God at Sinai. But from Sinai, you know what I mean? It doesn't, the grammar doesn't. Yeah, is the question clear to everyone? Yeah, it's a good question. Okay. Any other problems? Other problems? Consistency. There doesn't seem to be consistency here. It says Moses received the Torah from Sinai. What would you say the next sentence should be? Yeshua received it from Moses. Instead it says Moses received the Torah from Sinai and he transmitted it to Yeshua. So it's not consistent. Right? The first phrase is passive. Moses receives. The second phrase, it's Moses transmits. In other words, who is the subject of the first phrase? Right? I guess, grammatically, Moses is the recipient of the Torah. Whereas in the next phrase, it doesn't describe Joshua as the recipient, it describes Moses as the giver. Right? Masarli Yeshua. So those are a couple of the questions that we have. Those are all excellent questions. Let's try to figure out an answer to these questions. Okay. First of all, would it be appropriate to say the following? If it would have said Moses received the Torah from God and Joshua received it from Moses, would there be anything wrong with that?
Yes.
Moses received it from God, Joshua received it from Moses, the prophets, the elders received it from Joshua, and so on and so forth. Would there be any problem with that? Would you find that okay? You'd find it okay, could be, right? Any problem?
I think that by stating that, you'd be stating that the transmission is actually Moses' interpretation and not what it was directly. Because if you're receiving something from a person, you're receiving their objective view for it. You're not receiving the original. It could be like
But wouldn't that be a problem even the way it's phrased now? Would that be only a problem the way if I would say it that way? Or it's another issue, but you're right. Right, but why would that be more of a problem if I'd say Moses received it from God, Joshua received it from Moses? I mean, if you think about it, yeah.
You make an analogy that Moses is playing the role of God.
You're right. You see, there's a bit of a problem here. Whenever we talk about God, we're always going to run into a problem. The problem we're always going to run into is that God cannot be compared to anything or anyone. Right? So when we call God King, we don't think of King Louis or King Henry. Right? God forbid. Right? We don't think of that. We understand that it means something beyond that. So we always are very careful in our studies and very careful in our expression to always make a distinction. Make a distinction. Say, when we, for instance, in Hebrew, there's a word kiviyachol. What does kiviyachol mean? Anyone know any Hebrew? Kiviyachol, as if possible. When you talk about God doing something, very often we'll say kiviyachol, as if it would be possible to say it about God. It's not possible. So we don't want to create an equivalent between God transmitting to Moses and Moses transmitting to Joshua. Because what we're saying is relationship of Moses to Joshua, relationship of God to Moses, same, right? 6 inches from there to there, 6 inches from there to there, 6 inches from there to there, so on and so forth. That we don't want to say. Because the distance between Moses and God is a little bigger than the distance between Moses and Joshua, right? Is it making myself clear? Right, so therefore, we want to only hint at God. We don't want to actually put him in the sentence. Because if we put him in the sentence, we are creating an analogy between the relationship of God and Moses and the relationship of Moses and Joshua and all the rest of them, which is not true. Because the distance between God and Moses is huge, infinite. Whereas the distance between Moses and Joshua, it may be great, but it's not infinite, that's for sure. So that may be one possibility. Yeah.
So I have a question. So how come in the Chumash, right, it said, and Hashem said it like to Moshe's mouth, and then Moshe said it to Bnei Israel? Isn't that also kind of the same thing?
It doesn't say that. There's no sentence that actually puts it in that terms, right, in those terms. It says, though, it does say God spoke to Moses, and he told Moses, you tell it to the children of Israel. So it says God spoke to Moses, and he said to Moses, you tell it to the children of Israel. But you don't have a sentence where you're just creating this chain of that sort. So that's what we're worried about here. That also may be why it says Misinai from Sinai. Because you see, Moses at Mount Sinai, this week's Torah portion talks about it. We have this revelation of God at Mount Sinai. God reveals the Torah and gives it to the Jewish people at Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai does not just a geographical location. When we talk about Sinai, what we really mean is the revelation at Sinai. Right? For instance, there's a mitzvah in the Torah, it says to remember Ma'amad Har Sinai, standing at Mount Sinai. That doesn't mean, you know, everyone take pictures, we're all standing at Mount Sinai, group photo, right? So all the whole group stands in front of Sinai, we click like that, and that's the mitzvah, to remember that we're at Sinai, right? You know, or carve your name, you know, Gidon was here or something like that. The idea of remembering Sinai is not remembering a geographical location, but it's remembering the fact that at Mount Sinai there was a mass revelation. God spoke to the entire Jewish people. He didn't speak to one individual. He spoke to the entire Jewish people. So really when it says Moses received the Torah at Sinai, it's reminding us that it wasn't Moses by himself. He received the Torah, but it was witnessed by who? The whole Jewish people. Look at this week's Torah portion. God tells Moses, listen, when you come up to the mountain and you'll walk into the clouds and I'll speak to you, he says, the Jews will hear when I speak to you. Why? Gam becha yaminu la'olam, so they'll believe in you forever. Because God wanted the Jews also to know that when he spoke to Moses, it was not that we trust Moses. You go any religion, for instance, Islam. The Muslims believe that Muhammad has the word of God. Right? Did anyone witness God speak to Muhammad? Of course not. It happened where? It happened in private. It happened on a mountaintop in private. No one witnessed it. Which means if you trust Muhammad, fine. If you don't trust him, not good. Right? But basically, it's a matter of trusting Muhammad and taking him for his word. The same is true in Christianity. Okay, no one witnessed God speaking to Jesus or any of these other people. So therefore, you don't have to trust him. The same is true in virtually any religion, like the Mormons, Joseph Smith, etc. In Judaism, it's different. Why is it different in Judaism? Because in Judaism, all of the Jews had prophecy. Every single Jew at Mount Sinai became a prophet. And which means we all heard God speaking to Moses. It wasn't that we trusted Moses. It's that we saw with our own eyes and heard with our ears God speaking to him. We heard God say, Moses, I'm going to tell you this and this and this. Which means, when we say, Moshe Kibbel Torah Masinai, what we are trying to mention, what Judah the Prince is trying to mention here in the Mishnah is the experience of Mount Sinai, the revelation of Sinai, the fact that it was all the Jews there. Is this clear so far? Okay. Now, why is there a difference between the verbs? Moshe Kibbel Torah Masinai. Oh, by the way, one more point, which we could explain, Masinai might mean chronological. Meaning, when does Torah start? I know it sounds like a stupid question. When does Torah start? For example, Abraham did Bris Milah, he did circumcision, correct? Why are we obligated to do circumcision? Because Abraham did it? Why are we obligated to do it? Because God said, when did God say to do it? At Mount Sinai. My obligation to do mitzvot does not start with the patriarchs. I don't do anything because of tradition. I was speaking at a conservative synagogue in Verona. Tuesday night. Tuesday night I was speaking at a conservative synagogue in Verona, in New Jersey. So one of the congregants was saying that he was taught in his conservative school that they don't call God king. They don't call God king. Why? Because king is a political reality that's not relevant to us today. And therefore, they don't refer to God as king. Maybe they refer to the CEO. That's right. That could be a possibility. I didn't see that in the Siddur. But they don't refer to God as king. And the rabbi said, that's correct. He says, because we don't feel that, first of all, we believe that all men are created equal. And therefore, the idea of king is something which is not something that we like, right? Not something that we're comfortable with, right? Of course, I didn't point out God is not a people, but well, okay, whatever, right? He said we're not. So I said, but in the conservative prayer book, I asked the rabbi, in your conservative prayer book, it calls God king about 400 times. In their prayers, it says, Melech Ha'olam, king of the universe. So I said, why do you have, if you don't believe that God is king, you don't think of him that way, why in your prayer book do you have Melech? Right? It's a good question. I thought it was a good question. So the rabbi said, I said, why? He says, because it's traditional. Traditional. We don't want to just throw out the tradition. So I said to him, I said, I'm an Orthodox Jew. I am not traditional. I'm not. Conservatives are traditional. I'm not traditional. He said, what are you talking about? I said, I don't do anything because it's a tradition. I do it because it's true. If I did not think it was true, I wouldn't do it. Right? If I felt that when it says Melech, it's not true, I would rip that out. I would white it out of it. I wouldn't say it. I don't believe in saying something which is not true. Right? I don't do it just because of tradition. If my ancestors were pirates, I wouldn't go around pillaging people because it's a tradition in the Becher family. My tradition, right? Yeah, you know, my family played cricket. So, you know, I happen to like cricket, but if I didn't like cricket, I wouldn't play cricket just because my family played cricket. That's meaningless, right? I said to him, the fact that it's tradition, if you don't believe it's true, don't do it, right? So I said, Orthodox Jews don't believe in tradition. We believe in truth. It's just that we believe our tradition is true, right? But if you believe in tradition but you don't think it's true, that makes no sense to me. So you see, when we say, so Abraham did circumcision. He did circumcision. So I don't do it because Abraham did it. That's not why I circumcised my children. Nothing to do with that. I did it because God said to do it. At Mount Sinai. When Jacob and the sons of Jacob did stop, when he was touched on the sciatic nerve by the angel, you know the story, Jacob struggles, wrestles with the angel, right, the first UFC, right, they fight all night, etc. So the angel touches him, on the sciatic nerve and hurts his sciatic nerve, very painful. So it says in the Torah, since then we don't eat gid hanashe. You know what the gid hanashe is? The sciatic nerve of an animal. Jews do not eat the sciatic nerve of an animal since that time. Now, the truth is, the reason I refrain from eating the sciatic nerve of an animal is not because of Jacob, but it's because God said in the Torah not to. So when it says, Moshe Kibbel Torah, Misinai, where does the obligation of Torah start from? Chronologically, it starts from Sinai. So Sinai might not mean a location, it might mean a time. Moshe Kibbel Torah, Misinai, Moses received the Torah from Sinai onwards. And the only reason I have a connection to things before Sinai is because the Torah tells me I have that connection. So that's the idea. So there's a few possibilities of Sinai. There's one other possibility. Me Sinai, when you say from Sinai, in Hebrew, it's actually also true in English, but that from Sinai might also mean a cause, meaning what Moses received the Torah as a result of Sinai. What does that mean as a result of Sinai? Because the word Sinai, which is the Mount Sinai, what words are related to in Hebrew? Sinai. Why is it called Sinai? So there's actually, we know that that was the mountain where Moses first spoke to God, right? God first spoke to Moses. What happened? Moses is in a place, right? He's shepherding the flocks of his father-in-law. And he comes and he sees, what does he see? What's the first thing Moses saw? First time God spoke to Moses, what did Moses see?
A burning bush.
What's the bush in Hebrew? Sneh. Sneh, samach nun hei, right? And where did he see the snare? On this mountain. Mount Sinai is the mountain of the burning bush. It's the mountain of the bush. It's where first God first appeared to Moses. And the snare, the burning bush, is a symbol of humility. It's a symbol of lowliness. A tree is a symbol of arrogance, height. But the bush is a symbol of humility. So Moses was the one who received the Torah. Why? Because Moses was the most humble of all people. And it's on Sinai, not by coincidence, because it's the mountain of the bush. And it so happens there's a famous Midrash that tells us that it was the lowest mountain in the range. It was not chosen because of its height. Everest is higher. Mount Hawaii is higher. K2 is higher. Right? Mount Fuji is higher. Right? Mount Washington is higher, etc. Right? So every Jew would have in their car, I climb Mount Sinai. It's not true. Right? It's not because of the height. It was because of the lower. So it's a matter of humility. Now, it's interesting. The Kabbalists point out, this is also why it says, Moshe kibel Torah Masinai u'masara li Yeshua. The difference is the following. What's the difference between Moses received and he gave it over to Yeshua? So it's interesting, the Talmud says, Misira, which means handing over, requires what? Two participants, right? The one who hands and the one who accepts. Misira, as the Talmud says, is miyad liyad, that means from hand to hand. But kibel, lekabel, means to receive, right, could be something which is totally passive. For example, a cup, right? You could say in Hebrew, the cup received the wine. That's not the cup didn't put out its hand and say, give me some wine, right? The cup is just like a passive recipient, correct? So it works like this. Moses, this is the Zohar says this. When it says in the Torah, Moses, sometimes names are repeated. You ever notice this? Names are repeated in the Torah. God calls to Moses, he says, Moshe, Moshe. God calls to Avraham and he says, Avraham, Avraham. Yeshua, Yeshua, etc. Names are repeated. Now, it's very interesting. Why are the names repeated? What's the repetition of the name mean? It's like when I call my kid, Rafi, Rafi, Rafi. Could you come, right? I mean, I repeat the names 50 times, right? So that's not why God, it's not like God is saying, Abraham, Abraham, hello, right? That's not what it is, right? When the Torah says the word Abraham twice, it's not because, right, the kids are not listening. You know what I mean? Right, why is it? It's amazing. You know, my kids play in the attic, right? So I call them down sometimes. We're at the Shabbat table. They run up to the attic, right? They're playing. And I say, can guys, come down. Can't hear me, right? Then it's a dessert, right? Unbelievable, right? They from the attic, they hear me say whisper dessert. They come down straight away. It's unbelievable, right? So why is it repeated? So the Zohar says, because every person is living in two dimensions. We are living in this world, you see us in this world, but our soul, the highest level of the soul, is actually living in a spiritual world. It's living in Olam Haba. So we're connected to the world to come. We're living in two worlds simultaneously. The lowest level of the soul is here in the body in this world. The highest level of the soul is in a different dimension. Spiritual dimension. So when God says Avraham, Avraham, he's referring to the highest level of the soul and the lowest level. Okay? Is this clear? Now, it's interesting. The Zohar says the following. When the Torah has tunes, we sing the Torah. We don't read it, we sing it. So when it says Avraham, Avraham, or Yehoshua, Yehoshua, right, there's a slight pause in between the first name Moses and the second name, in the first name Avraham and the second Avraham. So when the person reads the Torah, when he says it, he'll say, Avraham, slight pause, Avraham, Yeshua, Yeshua, slight pause in between. When it's Moshe, Moshe, it says, Lo pasik tame begvei, there's no pause whatsoever in between the two names. So when you have to listen carefully to hear this, right? Now, you can't be talking about the financial pages of the New York Times during davening if you want to hear, right? It's got to be, so when the person reads it, you can hear a subtle pause, like a little break between Avraham, Avraham, but when it says Moshe, Moshe, Moses, Moses, no break whatsoever. What do you think that means? Given what I told you from the Zohar, what do you think that means?
Was in one body and soul at the same time.
Well, it means, obviously, yes, you're right, there's a close connection. If there's no break in the tune between Moshe, Moshe, you know what that means? The lowest level of the soul and the highest level of the soul completely and totally connected. There is nothing that gets between the two levels. Why? But when it says Avraham, Avraham, and there's a slight pause in between, what does that mean? That there is some level of disconnect. So it's interesting, and the Zohar says the following, because when Avraham described himself, you know how he described himself? He said, Anochi afar ve'efer. I am dust and ashes. When Moses described himself, he said, Nachnu ma, I'm nothing. Dust and ashes are
something.
So granted, the level of ego that was existed in Abraham is something which I wish we could all obtain, right? Now, if we all got that, I mean, it'd be unbelievable. If my name was in the Torah, say, Mordechai, 3,000 words later, Mordechai. So with Avraham, it's type of like there's a slight pause which you have to be an expert to pick up. It's not much, but it's there. Moses, no ego, the most humble of all people. So there's no pause between Moshe, Moshe. So therefore, when it comes to Moshe, it says Kibel Torah, because Kibel means that you can just pour it into him. And he absorbs it, and he accepts it, because he's an open, a kli, meaning a utensil that you can pour into. Whereas when it comes to every other generation afterwards, right, it's always what? There's a little bit of the other person's ego is involved in the transition. Someone pointed this out, that there's some level at which the person is not totally objective, right? When I tell you something, right, when I communicate with you, you communicate with me, each of us is going to be putting a little bit of ourselves into what you... I'm going to be putting a little bit of myself into what you said, and you're going to be putting a little bit of yourself into what I said. So that means there's a little bit, which is okay, that's normal. And God knows that we're humans. He knows we're going to do that. So therefore, that's fine. That's part of the process. With one exception. You know what the one exception was? Moses. He was the exception. There was nothing of Moses in the Torah. The Torah came to him, and there's no Moses in the Torah. There's a little bit of Joshua in what Moses transmitted. There's a little bit of the Nevi'im in what was transmitted. There's a little bit of Kainim, little bit... So. Anyway, there's a song like that, whatever, right? But a little bit of each. But there's not a little bit of Moses in what he receives. It's purely, and where did he get, and so to speak, what does that mean? That's from the attribute of Sinai, meaning from his incredible humility. Moshe Kibel Torah. Is this clear? So it's just a little bit of how the Kabbalists understand that first phrase. Someone had a question. I thought I saw a hand, or was that a twitch? Yeah.
What's the difference between humility and faith?
Well, humility probably requires faith. Faith is belief in something which you cannot absolutely bring evidence, right? It may be reasonable, but you cannot absolutely prove it. I mean, there's most things you cannot absolutely prove. Faith, right? Humility is a comparison of yourself to something greater and recognizing that you are dependent, recognizing that you are on a lower level. So, for example, humility doesn't mean that Moses didn't know his own abilities. He knew he was brilliant. He knew he was the probably the greatest scholar at the time. He was the greatest scholar at the time. However, who was Moses comparing himself to continuously? That's right. Because he had faith in God to such a high degree, he was continuously aware of the presence of God. So he's not comparing himself to the Jews. He's comparing himself to God. So I used to teach at a place called Or HaSameach in Israel. So the guys I used to teach there basically knew nothing. Guys who generally came to the yeshiva, they didn't know much. So, which means I'm teaching these people who know almost nothing every single day, right? I could get the impression that I knew a lot, right? I could feel that, like, guys don't even know Hebrew, and I'm right teaching. So every once a week, I'd go to a class of my teacher, Reb Moshe Shapiro, who gave a class to the staff at this place, Or HaSameach. So I walk into the shir, I begin to compare myself to Moshe Shapiro, I'm back to kindergarten. Right? The illusions of greatness that I had the rest of the week disappear Monday at 3:15. Because I walk into the class and he says, anyone who can read Hebrew should know that this is an obvious idea. And I'm saying, that's obvious, I don't even understand it. Right? I mean, it's like, I ask him a question, he rips me to shreds. It's unbelievable. It's very good for you. Right? So Moses was on a level where he's always comparing himself to, and compared to God, he's nothing. So he says, nach numa. Okay, that's humility. But humility is not saying that I'm not worth anything. It's not saying that I cannot do anything. It's saying, but whatever I can do, whatever I am worth, ultimately I owe that to God. So that's how he understands it. So that's what the Kabbalists say about Moshe Kibel Torah Mesinai. Umasara Li Yeshua. Now, someone asked the question, what do you mean one person? He gave it to all the Jews. So the answer here is, what we are talking about here is the oral law. It is true that Moses taught the Torah, oral and written, to all the Jews. That's true. But there's always going to be one person in the generation who is responsible for the transmission process. So when it talks about Joshua, it means he is the guy who's responsible for the accurate transmission and teaching of the Torah. Right? So yes, he taught it to everyone, but who's who's Where does the buck stop, as the Americans say? Where does the buck stop? The buck stops at Joshua. Joshua transmitted to the elders. The elders would then became the people responsible for transmission of the Torah. There's always got to be people responsible for that. Okay, that's the idea. That's how we understand that. Now, so Moshe kibbutz Torah Sinai, and he gave it to Yeshua. Yeshua to the elders. The elders to the prophets. The prophets gave it over to the men of the great assembly. So it doesn't end here, by the way. If you look through the rest of the chapter 1, it goes through each person received from the other person. So-and-so received from so-and-so, and it gives you the chain of transmission all the way down to the time of Judah the Prince, who actually wrote the Mishnah. In fact, a friend of mine, he heard something from a teacher of his and decided, I wonder where that teacher got it from. And he decided to start investigating it. So he found that his teacher, Rav Volbi, heard what he got from Rav Simcha Wasserman. Rav Simcha Wasserman heard that from his teacher, his father, Rav Elchanan Wasserman. Rav Elchanan Wasserman heard it from a rabbi at the beginning of the 20th century known as the Chafetz Chaim. You've heard of the Chafetz Chaim? So where did the Chafetz Chaim hear it from? The Chafetz Chaim heard it from Rav Chaim Oizer Grzinski, who was the rabbi of Vilna. Where did he hear it from? He heard it from a rabbi who was a student of the Gaon of Vilna, 1700s. Where did the Gaon of Vilna get it from? He got it from his teacher, right, in 1650. Right, he got it from a teacher, someone by the name of the Maharal, at the early 1600s. Where did the Maharal get that from? He got it from his teachers in Prague in the early 1500s. And he traced it back. And he found that it was actually the teachers in the 1500s, they received it from teachers who had come from Frankfurt to Prague in 1400s. And they got it from someone, and he kept tracing it back, and he found eventually that the tradition went back to actually someone by the name of Rashi in 1040 in France. I asked a kid at school, what did you learn today? He said, we learned about Rashi. I said, yeah? He said, yeah. The Rebbe said, our teacher said that Rashi lived during recess. I said, what are you kidding? He said, yeah. I said, what did the Rebbe say? He said, Rashi lived from 1040 to 1105. So Rashi, the great commentator in 1040, where did he receive it from? He received it from a teacher of his who actually got it from one of the Gaonim. Now, the Gaonim were the leaders of the academies in Babylon. So he got it from a Gaon who lived in approximately 900s. And the people in the Gaonim were the leaders of the yeshivas in Babylon. Now, the yeshivas in Babylon in 900 existed, were founded by the people who wrote the Talmud, which means the tradition goes back through the heads of the academies in Babylon to the teachers of the Talmud. The teachers of the Talmud heard it three generations earlier from the last people who were the teachers of the Mishnah that we're learning now. And in the Mishnah, you can trace it back all the way through Ethics of the Fathers, right, all the way back to Hillel and Shammai and Shmaya and Avtalion and Antignos, and Antignos received from Shimon HaTzadik, who was the last of the men of the Great Assembly, who was the beginning of the first, Second Temple era, and the men of the Great Assembly received it from the last prophets. The last prophets lived at the time of the men of the Great Assembly. Ezra and Nehemiah, etc. And Ezra and Nehemiah, of course, were in a direct line from Daniel, and Daniel, and Isaiah, and Ezekiel, and keep going back until you get to Moses. So the thing that he heard from his teacher on investigation, he found a chain that goes all the way back to Moses at Sinai. And that is what we are saying here in this particular Mishnah. Moses received the Torah at Sinai, gave it to Joshua, and so on and so forth, all the way down to present times. And they said, and let me quickly finish, because I feel guilty not even finishing the Mishnah, even though, I mean, it was a little ambitious to even think that we'd finish the whole page that you got, but okay, whatever. So what did they say? Three things. They said three things. Now, clearly, that statement is not correct. That statement makes sense? Do you think 120 rabbis only said three things? Give me a break. Do you know any Jew who's only said three things? Yeah. 120 rabbis, they said three things. So commentaries point out that in Ethics of the Fathers, that everything is selected stuff. Certain things are said here because that was what the person, his life, said that. In other words, sometimes things were selected because that person, you looked at that person, his life was a statement of that. For example, why is Rabbi Israel Meir Kagan, why is he called the Chafetz Chaim? Because his life was a verse in Psalms. You know what verse in Psalms was? Mi ha'ish ha'chafetz chaim? Who is the man who loves life? Netzor l'shoncha meira, guard your tongue from evil. Usfatecha medaber mima, and your lips from speaking iniquity. So if you would look at that man and his life, you know what verse would come to mind? That pasuk. Mi ha'ish ha'chafetz chaim. Certain people you'd look at, and they would be a living verse of the Torah. Living verse of the Torah. So therefore, sometimes things are selected here because that was the person represented. Sometimes they're selected because that was needed at that particular generation, that particular time. Sometimes they're selected because he did one thing that you may have learnt something wrong from, so he wants to correct your mistake. Rabbi Akiva, in Ethics of the Fathers, you know what Rabbi Akiva says? He says, laughter and frivolity will take you right out of this world. Now, that's a weird thing. You know why? Because Rabbi Akiva, there are five times throughout the Talmud where Rabbi Akiva laughs when everyone else is crying. You've heard the famous stories? Rabbi Akiva, they see the foxes in the Holy of Holies. All the rabbis are crying. What's Rabbi Akiva doing? He laughs. Rabbi Eliezer, his teacher, is suffering. Everyone else is crying. Rabbi Akiva's smiling. Right? They hear the Romans celebrating their victory. Everyone starts crying. Rabbi Akiva starts laughing. There are at least five or six places where Rabbi Akiva laughed. Why did Rabbi Akiva laugh? Because he was able to see a little deeper and see that the destruction was a cause for redemption. He was able to see the good in everything and the final goal. So therefore, because you might make a mistake of thinking that Rabbi Akiva said, look, don't take anything seriously, laugh it all off, that's not what he was saying. So in Ethics of the Fathers, Rabbi Akiva comes along and tells us, hello, that's not what you should say. So when they said three things, it means these are selected statements. So let's end with the statements. It says three things. Metunim b'din, be deliberate, slow in judgment. Ha'amidu talmidim harbe, have lots of students. Va'asu siyag l'Torah, make a fence around the Torah. I would say these are three areas of life. Thought, speech, action. Thought, speech, and action. Have a metunim b'din, don't rush to judgment. Think. Most people don't think about what they're doing. Most people don't think about what they hear. Most people don't think. Right? Bertrand Russell, George Bernard Shaw once said, he said, most people, he said, think maybe once or twice a year. He said, I have become famous because I think once or twice a week. Right? Unfortunately, that's the way it is. So what it says, the first thing is, machshava, think. Don't be quick to judge a person. Don't be quick to come to a conclusion in Jewish law. Don't be quick to do anything, be deliberate, thought. Speech, have many students, meaning communicate Torah. Every Jew is obligated to be a teacher, right? To teach other people, to teach the world, to teach ourselves, teach each other through speech. When we speak to each other, when we communicate Torah to each other, we understand it that much better. When I'm teaching someone else, I have to learn it much better than if I'm just doing it myself. I do it myself. I say, oh, yeah, simple. I understand that. Then I explain it to someone. He says, what does that mean? I said, oh, good point. Right? So I have to rethink it. So speech, very important. And the third area is asusiag, make a fence around the Torah, meaning things which are precious to you, right? Your actions should be very, very careful. Make a fence around things, because if it's precious to you, you have to protect it. So therefore, I don't have time to go through the whole thing, otherwise we'll be here all night. But those are the three statements. Thought, action, speech and action. Some would say Matunim Bedin refers to the study of Torah. Hamidu Talmidim Harbe means the teaching of Torah. Asusiag l'Torah means the fulfillment of Torah. So there is study, teaching and fulfillment. Each one you have to do, right? No one can get, so that's what they had to do. So that's what they had to say. Okay, we'll stop here. Maybe at some time in future we'll continue and perhaps even finish the first Mishnah. But at the moment, that's it for this evening. Thank you very much.
Hey, so, everybody, sit down for one moment, please. Just a quick announcement. And then we'll...